A professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University, Ted Olson has submerged himself in the region's music, literature, history, and beauty, finding various ways to share what he's discovered through teaching, writing, and even interpreting for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
My work has always been about bringing stories from the past into the present.
Ted Olson talks about editing the works of the late Kentucky writer James Still and reads some of his own poetry today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and while he was at the 2018 Folk Alliance International Conference in Kansas City, he shared how someone born in Massachusetts and raised in D.C. became so integrated into the Appalachian culture. Here's Ted Olson.
Washington, D.C. was the site of a lot of expats, out migrants from Appalachia who, you know, they weren't leaving Appalachia for political reasons per se, but for economic reasons, people seeking work in the big city. So in the 60s and 70s, when I was living there, Washington had a kind of an underground Appalachian culture. You would hear the musicians, you would meet the folks at various activities. The Smithsonian would have this folk festival, and I attended it regularly. Met some Appalachian musicians and other creative types, artisans and such, who carried the Appalachian ethos, and they would share these stories and these songs with me as an open-eyed kid. And of course, that's when my awareness came that there was this place, largely rural, very close to D.C., and it kind of opened my eyes that the realities that I was seeing around me, the politics and the racial strife of D.C., was one story, one narrative, but that there was much more out there. And I started to, as soon as I could, make forays into the mountains, you know, as a teenager, camping and backpacking and hitchhiking. It was a counter-narrative to life's possibilities. And as I befriended people from Appalachia on my visits there, I just felt called there to work and to serve the function of cultural intermediary.
Well, the thing that I find remarkable is that neither you nor James Still were from Appalachia originally, and yet you both were so grounded there.
James Still certainly was a similar sort of story. He came to Appalachia to kind of find himself. I mean, originally I think it was to find work, but he ultimately found his voice there and became one of the great writers of Appalachia. And I was very honored to work with him at the end of his life, helping to collate and edit his collected poems. And after his death, about 15 years ago, I continued to work on his papers, producing a collected short stories volume that was in some ways the deepest level of engagement that I had with his work. It was ironically after he past, I was challenged to coordinate all his masterful short stories into a single volume, and that was a very complex process that took several years.
You know, I read what you wrote about that. It took a lot of detective work to figure out which was the newest version of short stories, and then also there are some short stories that were included in one of his famous novels.
James Still was endlessly tinkering with his work.
All writers do.
Of course, because all writers are craftsfolk who really want the best possible way to convey a thought, a feeling, an idea. James Still had multiple versions of every short story, and I had to determine what was the final intended version. And there had been some editorial manipulation of his work by others over the years, and that was another factor. And then you mentioned his great novel, River of Earth, and he had incorporated a number of his short stories into that novel. The original short story versions, in most cases, were different from the versions in the novel, and so we had to kind of go back to the original for those. And it seemed to me that the original versions of the short stories worked perfectly separated from the novel, even though they work beautifully within the novel's context. So it was an interesting activity for sure.
Yeah, the book is called The Hills Remember, The Complete Short Stories of James Still. It's a beautiful book. I love the cover. Who did the artwork?
Well, I located this particular painting at a gallery in Asheville, North Carolina, by Will Henry Stevens, who's an acclaimed Depression-era painter.
Perfect.
From the South. And he didn't romanticize Appalachia, and I think that was important for me when representing James Still's work. James Still's prose is very poetical. His poetry is very much like song and balladry. It's very traditional in its tone. Will Henry Stevens, I think, had that same essence. He kind of captured the poetry of Appalachia, the culture and the landscape. And so it was a perfect fit, Will Henry Stevens and James Still.
Yeah, it really is a perfect fit. Well, you mentioned his poetic voice. I noticed that there are a couple of poems from New Letters magazine that he published years ago. I thought you'd be interested in actually seeing the magazine itself. It's from 1984-85, and he was published in here with Robert Bly, Hayden Carruth, Raymond Carver, Richard Rhodes. But I thought I might get you to read these two poems. They're back to back in here. And they also appear in his new and collected poems. That was the first book that you worked with James Still on, called From the Mountain, From the Valley.
What have you heard lately? What have you heard lately from Sulphur Trestle? Nothing, huh? Nothing worth telling? No news is bad news. Nobody got killed? A tree never fell on nobody? Not a soul smashed to jelly in a side-swiped flivver? Or blowed up at a sawmill? Daggone! Hey, you say Buck Sampson got 6 months for taming his high-stepping floozy, though she deserved every lick he hit her? Now you're talking. So Lily Jenkins went crazy and stripped in the courthouse square? And you and your ex-wife are still going round and round? And Gone with the Wind is back at the Bijou? And that old doll who broke us both in is still switching her tail about town? And how are you? Doing no good? Me either. Madly to learn. Madly to learn, to fathom, to discern, to master the Gobi, the ruins at Petri, climb K2 and Nanga Parbat, swim the Strait of Malacca, be Ahab aboard the Pequod, Milton in his agony, Shakespeare treading the boards. To unravel, to grasp, to speak Freud's theory of seduction, the mathematical beauty of irregular surfaces, the quantum theory, the leaping genes, the invisible morphogenetic fields transmitted across space and time, bridges to infinity, and why Tennyson's flower in a crannied wall may not tell us all and all and all. Madly to learn.
Sing me on the lay, oh, carry me away.
We just heard the writer Ted Olson, who helped compile the works of James Still, read two of James Still's poems that happened to be published in New Letters magazine back in 1984. What Have You Heard Lately and Madly to Learn. Both of those poems are in James Still's collection From the Mountain, From the Valley, new and collected poems that were edited by Ted Olson, who is here with me today. And this is New Letters on the Air. Isn't that an interesting juxtaposition, his poem that has more of the feel of the everyday man, and then Madly to Learn just takes us into the world of literature and across the globe?
For those who expect all of James Still's literary creations to focus on Appalachia, I mean, this kind of suggests otherwise, that he had a very active intellectual life while he stayed in Appalachia for 7 decades. Arriving there fully bloomed in his adulthood, but lived a very long time. He traveled a great deal, read voluminously, and was really quite an intellectual, and these poems reflect that.
You've got to tell the story about when you first met him, because you were just a college student, right?
At the University of Kentucky, where I was a graduate student, UK had sponsored, I believe it would have been a 50th anniversary celebration of the publication of River of Earth, James Still's great Depression-era novel. And if folks haven't heard of River of Earth, certainly they owe it to themselves to seek it out. It's really a majestic novel, in some ways fully at the level, although very different, as The Grapes of Wrath, more poetical than The Grapes of Wrath, maybe in some ways less complex, but it has its own simple beauty, River of Earth does. So the 50th anniversary celebration brought James Still to campus. People in the drama department enacted scenes from River of Earth and that sort of thing. Then there was a book signing. And so I got in a very long line to have my copy of River of Earth signed by James Still. And, you know, after a time, maybe half an hour, I finally got to the point where it was my turn. And James Still had, I think, gotten worn out by that time where I don't even think he looked up, you know. But there was a presence about him and a humility. And I can completely respect the fact that he wasn't maybe absorbed in the celebrityism of the moment. But shortly thereafter, I followed up with correspondence. And he wrote back immediately. And it was clear that he was interested in fans who were truly connected to his works. So I had a correspondence with him about River of Earth, leading to a scholarly article in which I compared and contrast River of Earth with The Grapes of Wrath. What are the parameters of what becomes canonical and what leads another work of great skill and achievement to fall by the wayside? And I think he appreciated the effort to come up with a reasonable explanation as far as why that happened. And so we became friends, and at some point I just said, you have this wonderful legacy of poetry, and it's kind of scattered to the four winds, and there were a few wonderful volumes in print that were not complete collections. So it was time to have a complete poetry collection, and he was definitely on board with working with me, which was a great honor, and we worked on it for at least 2 years, and then, of course, sadly, he passed away. Ironically enough, when From the Mountain, From the Valley was published, we had scheduled a joint book signing tour. James Still and I were to have taken this around the region and perhaps further. And very sadly, about a week before the book was slated to be published, James Still passed away. And so the scheduled book signing tour became a memory tour. And at every stop, friends and fans of James Still came out, and I was kind of emceeing memorial services all over the state of Kentucky and Appalachia, and it was very poignant. It was from that experience of befriending James Still toward the end of his life and working through all his poems and collecting them into this book, and of course he was a very active participant in that project, where I realized that commitment to serving a region's history and cultural narrative is a very profound endeavor indeed. And James Still had done that his whole life. And it felt, interestingly, like a affirmation of my own commitment to do that. And it's empowered me ever since.
I'm Angela Elam, and I'm here in the studio with Ted Olson talking about the different parts of his life and work. And Ted, I was trying to figure out how we were going to springboard into your own poetry, because you've published 3 books of poetry. Revelations in 2012 by Celtic Cat. And then in 2006, you had Breathing in Darkness by Wind Publications. Talk a little bit about your own poetry and when you started writing.
I've been interested in poetry as I've been interested in folk song and balladry from an early age. Since I was a teenager, if not before, I've always found myself interested in limericks, a child's garden of verses and things such as that. By the time I was in high school, I felt like poetry was an opportunity to live deeply in a culture that seemed trendy and ephemeral. And I don't mean that too harshly, but let's just put it this way. I felt that the popular culture had its value, but wasn't that sustaining or satisfying. And I wanted to find a deeper connection. I guess that connection was yearning to be connected to a past that was viable and honest and deeply rooted. And so poetry and also folk song and balladry, I think, provided that vehicle to travel back in time. And so I started to read poetry by a wide range of writers. Certainly my mother was very encouraging to that endeavor. She would come home some days and bring books of poetry by T.S. Eliot or Dylan Thomas or Robinson Jeffers. And I really was very appreciative of that, because I don't know if that happens in every young person's life. Always kind of encouraging whatever activities I might do. And it's usually sort of done tacitly without a lot of overt kind of expectation. For example, my immersion in folk music, a lot of that came from her record collection. You know, when I was perhaps too young to even verbalize what the music was, I listened to her records and they were deeply moving, and probably 8, 9 years old, that sort of thing.
Wow.
But then as a teenager, poetry really entered my life. It also provided me a forum to kind of resolve some inner conflicts that every person encounters. I started to write limericks, just like the ones I was reading, you know, as a preteen, I suppose, and parodies of popular songs. I remember writing a parody of American Pie, you know, John Denver's Thank God I'm a Country Boy. You know, these are just ways to become more conversant with language and to feel kind of empowered. And the fact that it starts out imitating other existing work is, I think, fairly typical. But somewhere along the way, perhaps early 20s, I just realized that poetry was the most meaningful thing that I did, maybe in complementing the music that I played. And I didn't really pursue publication very intensely until, I suppose, after I had a very meaningful dialogue with a professor of mine at the University of Kentucky, the very well-known and acclaimed, of course, very talented visionary writer Wendell Berry.
Oh, right.
Who provided me a perspective on what it means to be a poet in the modern world. And I think that was an extremely important moment for me.
Wendell Berry is such an important poet, but I did not know until I read something that you wrote that he was a protege of James Still.
That's right. Wendell often talked about how important James Still was to his life, encouraging him to be true to his own voice, write for himself, not for editors, think long-term about his ultimate goals, not be too caught up in publication for its own sake, these sorts of lessons. And there are many more wonderful statements that Wendell made about James Still in an essay that Wendell wrote about James Still. Wendell Berry was a very challenging teacher. I often tell people that the number of people who signed up for his class versus the number who finished his class, it was a marked decline of registrants in that class because his standards were so high, and I managed to stay with it to the end, and I'm so glad I did. Very important to have teachers in one's life who make an impact. He certainly did make an impact on me. Of course, Wendell Berry started writing in the 60s. I started reading Wendell Berry in the 70s, but he was the one who encouraged me not to be too quickly satisfied with what I did in the form of poetry. I think I didn't have a deep enough sense of craft before he said these words to me in a very tactful way. I think he was very good about getting a very strong point across. My poems weren't quite realized yet, and I couldn't have agreed more in retrospect. He was absolutely honest, and, you know, it's not easy to be honest in this world. I really appreciated that. So at some point, I just realized that I needed to pay a lot more attention to craft.
Well, I'm curious if in one of these collections there might be a poem that you feel was really helped along by Wendell Berry.
I suppose this is a poem that relates to that kind of agrarian sensibility that he brings to all his work. Questions. Where will all the farmers go as their farms are bought and sold? Will they end up in cities? How will their grandchildren know of truths their grandparents told, forecasting through homilies the coming of drought, of snow, words too urgent to be old, warning folks, get on your knees, someday you'll reap what you sow. And what can the future hold for people with no stories? Who'll say how to make or grow things, to endure heat and cold? When will they think to plant trees?
Questions from the book Revelations, poems by Ted Olson. This is New Letters on the Air. You teach right now at East Tennessee State University in the Appalachian Studies Department. It's interesting to me how much of your life has been pulled in by Appalachia. You've been involved with James Still. You love the music from the region. And you are a musician yourself and have produced all sorts of bodies of work. I'm looking at one right here in front of me, On Top of Old Smoky, New Old Time Smoky Mountain Music. There's several other collections that you've done as well. Talk about that part of your life.
Sure. I've been playing music three quarters of my life, and pretty early on, it was clear that the repertoire that I wanted to learn and that I wanted to share with others was the Appalachian music heritage, the ballads, the folk songs, the folk tunes, and the stories behind the music. And so I started to play music in West Virginia when I was working at a camp there.
How old were you at that point?
18, 19.
Okay.
So that was the point at which I first started to take the lessons I had learned from records and from books and from the people I had met at the Smithsonian Annual Festival and take the music back to people. And the people I played the music for in West Virginia were campers at a summer camp from Washington, D.C. That was one audience. But the other audience, which was in some ways more daunting, was to play that music back for the locals near the camp where I worked. And so I befriended a number of West Virginians who thought it was maybe a little bit odd that this teenager was so interested in maybe a traditional music that originated from that same part of the world. And yet they were very supportive of it. And I developed a duo, I suppose you would say, with a gentleman who was from West Virginia named Jack Schaffenaker, who was a tremendously talented guitar player. And since I played the banjo, it was a natural combination. And we played together for several years around West Virginia. And it was just a wonderful immersion experience for me. And after working at the summer camp and getting that formative experience with music and learning the stories behind the music, I took the experiences to the National Park Service, working as a park ranger, as an interpreter of Appalachian cultural and natural history. I felt that the next step after playing kind of as an interpreter was to take a deep dive into the scholarly history of Appalachia. And so then I went back to graduate school and got a degree in literature, but my dissertation was a focus on Appalachian folklore and folk life. And so that just was a springboard into doing the work that I do now, which is kind of a holistic study of Appalachian culture. And what I try to do is to put my awareness I have gained about Appalachian values, I try to, again, serve as a kind of intermediary, as an interpreter between this knowledge and the broader world. And in addition to literary endeavors, I've also been involved with musical endeavors, taking the songs, ballads, and tunes of many people of Appalachia to the world. And some of the projects I've done have, in fact, been more widely received far beyond Appalachia. I mean, I've done a number of box sets of Appalachian music for a German company, Bear Family Records, that have been reviewed all over the world. So it's been very gratifying. It's been, of course, a challenge to recover stories that have been long lost. A lot of the music that I work on is music from the 20s and 30s and that sort of thing. One box set that I worked on, the Bristol Sessions, brought back famous recording sessions that launched country music. But a lot of the stories behind them, people knew the records by the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers, but they didn't really know the larger context until working with some colleagues, we kind of brought those stories out and certainly reintroduced the music to people.
You've been up for several Grammys in the production of your work. I think six, maybe?
I've been very blessed with that degree of reception for the sets that I've released. The nominations have been for Best Historical Album and also for Best Liner Notes, or Album Notes, they call them. And so basically those are craft awards. And, you know, I continue to work at it. And one has to do these projects for love of the music, love of the stories behind the music, love of the culture that produced the music and the story. But the acknowledgement is, of course, very gratifying. And I think it does help to bring the work to a broader audience.
Yeah, I think it does, too. Do you do songwriting at all?
You know, I've never really pursued songwriting. In some ways, songwriting is a good deal more lucrative, if one is worried about such things, than writing poems. I've written a few songs, I suppose. You know, of course, they have to be matched carefully to melody and chord structure. But I've always kind of kept my interest in music and poetry separate, which is a curious thing. I've not brought it together.
It is a curious thing. Well, maybe that's ahead.
One thing I have thought is that I feel as if the kinds of stories, the kinds of explorations that I seek to do in a poem, I've never found a way to go that deeply into those experiences in song form. I mean, I've tried a few times. I do feel that sometimes poems can go to places that songs can't go. I really want to acknowledge that. I mean, poems, to be memorable and this sort of thing, have to have elements of musicality, you know, sound and rhythm and these sorts of things. But while I appreciate the great songwriters, like anyone who loves great cultural expression, I feel that poems can go to a place that songs can't go.
You know, I can't get over how dovetailed everything is in your life. You know, you've got this work of other people's that James Still, Appalachian writer, then you've got Appalachian music, and then you've worked for the Smoky Mountains, and I know you've written some stuff for the Smoky Mountain Trails guidebook, so you must be a big hiker.
Right.
I can't imagine you living anywhere but the Appalachians now. I mean, it's so much a part of you.
Well, the interesting thing for me is that a deep immersion into the realities of the place where you live helps one to feel at home outside where one lives. It's an interesting irony that I feel better situated to live in the world, maybe anywhere, because I know what it means to live in one place.
You know, in your earlier book, Breathing in Darkness, you have a poem that refers to the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it's called Swallows. I thought I might get you to read that.
Sure. This is one of the earliest poems in this collection. It's linking back to what we were talking about with Wendell Berry encouraging me to have kind of a sharper sense of craft. The original draft of this from perhaps 1980 was just sitting in a notebook somewhere. So I went back to this poem after taking Wendell Berry's class and thinking about some of his lessons taught to us. So this poem is basically a recast version of an older one and put together in the early 1990s, but based on an earlier experience of immersion in the Blue Ridge Mountains as a very young person. Swallows. Alone in this valley of 1,000 mountains, the Blue Ridge Mountains, by the Shenandoah River, I'm walking, watching water meander over the old rocks, wash them away. Limestone, mostly, some sandstone and shale, dissolving. Outside the framed farmhouse, I pause, knowing no one is home this late September evening. I shall step back in, my boots worn like the door screen. I stumble, my graceless feet trampling the floorboards into dust. Now I trespass in the place of swallows. They swoop for my eyes, and so I cower where once I crawled. I recall seeing swallows then, but then they lived in cavities, in banks and trees, not in our house. And yet, I'm not surprised to find them hiding here from me. My kin stole flight from them. And once, for fun, I flung stones at them, but missed, hit only my window. I can't look back now, can't see my path as one dissolving. In the darkest room of the house, I part the curtains. Moonlight pours through broken panes.
Ride the ring, rattle-dee-oh, rattle-diddle-day, tee, rattle-diddle-day.
Swallows, from Ted Olson's poetry book, Breathing in Darkness. He also read from Revelations from Celtic Cat Publications, as well as from the book he edited of James Still's collected poetry, From the Mountain, From the Valley, with sprinklings of music from the 2017 two-disc album called Big Bend Killing, the Appalachian Ballad Tradition, that features contemporary musicians performing traditional tunes, a project in support of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park that brought Ted Olson his 6th Grammy nomination. For links, visit newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Dylan Cramhorn, Ashley Coate, Danny Reeves, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.